Hello, and thanks again for joining us here on Core Ideas, the podcast where we delve into all things related to Lake Sediments. My name is Adam Jaziorski, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Josh Steenpot.
Hey, how's it going?
And for once, I'm not going to ask you what you want to talk about today, because we're doing part three.
We're just rolling along. Part three. Wow. And when we were planning this out, in the last episode, if you've listened to it, I said, oh, we can definitely finish it in episode three. Spoiler alert, we're not going to finish it. There's still quite a bit left to talk about in the history of paleolimnology. So this is three of four, question mark?
Four-ish.
Yeah, but maybe we should start with a little reminder of where we were after episodes one and two.
Okay. So this is part three of the history of paleolimnology, and it's our attempt to construct a rough history of how we got to where we are today in the subdiscipline of paleolimnology. Part one was very much about establishing which are some of the main shoulders that the first paleolimnologists need to stand on before the discipline could really emerge as its own thing. And so that in terms of science in general, microbiology, taxonomy, chemistry, geology, limnology, ecology. In part two, we looked more specifically at some of the pioneers of paleolimnology itself, a little bit about the importance of the Hutchinson group at Yale to ecology and limnology in general, and ended with a little bit about the development of coring equipment. And that takes us to today, where all the bits and pieces were in place for some real rapid development as early paleo developed and matured from largely qualitative analyses into the quantitative approaches that we're familiar with today. And that was really driven, at least we're making the argument today, and it was largely driven by methods to date the sediments and the advances in computing power that allowed multivariate statistics to be done by humble biologists.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's we're making it, so that's a strong place to start our argument. But from a paleo perspective, if you look at where we are today, we finished with taking cores. We have to add a chronology to the cores, and most people are applying some sort of statistical approach. And certainly as paleolimnology matured, as we'll finish with today in the acid rain debates, that was critical for being able to carry out the types of analyses that were essential to making paleolimnology sort of, I don't want to say a household name because that's not necessarily the case, but broadly applicable in the environmental sciences. So yeah, should be a good little chat.
Yeah. And some of the stuff we'll plug our old stuff. We've talked about in some detail before about specifics of dating, which I believe was in episode three, which seems like a very, very long time ago.
No kidding. I think that's more a function of the world than it is function of the number of episodes. Yeah, exactly.
But we've also dedicated a full episode to transfer functions, which was when we're talking about multivariate statistics. And there we were talking about just how it's done as opposed to the importance of how big a development it was for paleo. And similarly, we've dedicated an episode talking about the importance of computing power. So all these, like the repetitive strands, but here we're talking about in our history of paleolimnology.
Yeah, in the context of all of the other things, for sure. Those were sort of standalones and what, and this is sort of when, and also a little bit of why, maybe.
Yeah. And I think, just to put a little emphasis, this is our history or a history. We've left a lot of stuff out, and some people may be offended by what we've picked and chosen. But that's just a product of, this is our show. This is our perspective in terms of our inherent biases based on being North Americans, so we're most familiar with, North American examples of acidification is what's going to come up here. We'll try and refer to Europe a little bit, but it's just, honestly, we're less familiar with it. In terms of lineages and stuff, we've not attempted to leave anybody out. It's just more a case of you know, what we know and what we come across in the very, very, very detailed research sessions that we perform before each of these episodes.
Yeah, exactly. But off we go if that's the case. And so I guess to start, let's start with dating, because after taking a core, you know, it's not really that useful to be able to perform a principal components analysis if you don't really know when the dates for individual intervals and for that entire core fall. The importance of dating and just establishing some sort of chronology in general is fundamental to modern paleolimnology, particularly if you're interested in environmental questions, which are very recent. If you're talking about thousands of years ago over, you know, the last glacial kind or the post-last glacial cycle, then being a little bit more hand-wavy that this was a long time ago, this is more recent towards the surface is going to be fine. But you need to really be able to nail that chronology if you're going to talk about changes that occurred in a year or a couple of years time period. And that's the kind of detail necessary if you're going to use them for regulatory kind of applications like we're done with acid rain, for example.
Yeah, or if you're trying to tie it to the establishment of a mine or the building of a dam. Like when you're trying to tie something to a particular event, that you need to know where in your core that event actually occurred. And in order to do that, you need to be able to date your sediment intervals. And prior to the 1970s, the ability to do that was highly, highly limited. You're either limited to VARs, which we've talked about before. They're basically the alternating couplets of light, dark layers of sediment that occur in some lakes that are an annual event, so you can count backwards through time. But the number of lakes where VARs form is very, very limited. So it can't be applied broadly. And then outside of that, the other only real option was using radiocarbon dating, which was, you know, cutting edge, you know, developed in like the late 1940s, and is not really appropriate for, you know, the last couple of centuries. It's been dealing with a radioisotope that has a 5,700 year half-life. And so it just doesn't have the precision for working at the very, very top of cores or things that have happened, or at least in the 1970s in the last couple of decades.
Yep, exactly. That's it. Yeah, if it's all radiocarbon modern, then that's not going to be much help. The only other thing would be to have some sort of like biological fossil marker. We talked about the ambrosia pollen or ragweed pollen rise. But if you do that, you have a single point and then you have the surface and you can draw a nice straight line between them. But if there's any variation, you would have no idea in the sedimentation rate. You would have no idea that existed, and your interpretations could be wildly inaccurate because of that.
And we referred to a little bit in the last episode how the study of VARs was pioneered around the turn of the 20th century by Baron Gerard de Geer, and when he and some other Swedish researchers recognized how similar VARs were to tree rings. And then going from there, by the 1920s, you're starting to see work like that of Fritz Nipkow, published his PhD thesis in 1927, looking at diatom assemblages within specific VARs in Lake Zurich. And
yeah, we were having a flip through of that thesis, that PhD thesis from, I think it's from
27,
from the University of Zurich anyway, but it was shocking how modern it seemed. Now, it's all written in German, so I think we can be excused for missing it in our earlier discussions of the fairly early history of paleolimnology. But my goodness, does it seem like we were a little bit late when we identified the first first modern paleolimnologist, because, you know, the figures are hand drawn, but you could have identical things in a paper published
today. Yeah, this totally blew my mind. So it's one of those things where this is a PhD thesis from almost 100 years ago. So again, it's in German. So it kind of reveals our biases a bit. I'd never seen it before, but it's seen like it mentioned in a footnote or a reference in John's talk. But then actually looking at it, I was really shocked by how modern it was, not just in terms of the content, but in terms of like the typesetting. Yeah. You know, and then we like went, oh man, we're way off. So we rolled it back to like his supervisor's thesis, which was like from 1910. I was like, okay, no, this makes more sense than what my perception of like an early 20th century piece of science is supposed to look like. Yeah, it's written in like Gothic
font.
Yeah. But Nipkow's thesis, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes when they eventually go up for anyone that's interested. But yeah, it definitely changed my paradigm of when, what science was like in the 1920s.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever said, absolutely, you must go and have a look at this link in the show notes. Though you should, because Adam works really hard on them. But you really have to go and have a look at this, because it is pretty impressive, considering it's 90 plus years old.
Yeah, and I think we've talked before when we're talking about like citations or papers or something about, you know, the bias of what is available online, and like that window moved back around the time when I was just starting to do my undergraduate work. Like there was a wall of like when it, and I don't know when that got pushed back into the 1920s, and maybe I've just not looked at enough stuff from the 1920s. But I've looked at stuff from like, you know, the 60s and 40s, a fair number of like papers that let's say are more than 50 years old. But I'm not, I guess I've not looked at too many that are like 100 years old, as opposed to reviews summarizing older work. No, this is crazy to me. Anyway, it's a serious aside, but...
Serious aside, but I think one that fits, it's not just an aside for the sake of it. It fits into this discussion of the history of paleomnology. Have a look at it. There were people doing some very, what we would think of as modern paleolimnology quite a long time ago. And great work.
Very recognizable as a work of paleomnology.
But then in other parts of this, we've talked about varves more generally. So we talked about Bradley in the 30s looking at marine, non-glacial marine varves in the United States. I don't think we've discussed it yet because it's kind of pushing where we left off in some ways, timeline-wise. But Roger Tippett in the mid-60s described annual variations in varves in a lake in Ontario called Little Round Lake, which one might be familiar to maybe our Canadian listeners. John Small himself has worked on this lake a little bit. It's not far from Kingston, Ontario, probably part of that story, but a very well-studied lake and looking at varves at that time period.
Yeah, and then, like, there's a bit of a time jump then from the 30s to the 60s, but then that's when we're starting to see, I guess, more and more, I don't know if there's a little bit of renewed interest in paleomnology in coming out of the 60s and the environmental movement that we've talked about, but then all of a sudden... there's just more stuff available, more equipment available. So in the 1970s, 1980s, freeze coring techniques are becoming more commonly used. And then also tape peel methods, where you're combining varves and then using tape to peel off the outermost section of a freeze core so that you can then slice the tape very, very finely to get into varve and subvarve intervals. So almost looking at seasonal succession. And like,
yeah, well, I think that was part of the reason for that is in order to, well, there was, I think it was just an explosion in science in general post-war. That's the dog in the background. Apologies for those of you on listening. Just post-war, there was such a explosion of people doing research everywhere. And the basic ecology was part of that. It's kind of linked into the, you know, when the people at Yale and Hutchinson and all those people were studying all of these things, I think they just brought up general questions about the ecological nature of the environment. And one of those things is about the seasonal changes. And one way to do that is to go and monitor all the time. But that's hard in northern Finland, where, you know, going and seasonally measuring all the time, or anywhere, you know, I think it's in southern Finland that they worked. But sediment cores might give you a way of doing that. It's a way of looking at the environment without having to be there all the time and having these really high definition, for lack of a better term, tape peels of seasonal changes in phytoplankton and all those things was one way to fill in that gap of monitoring.
Yeah, and there's a particularly intense, crazy, insane expression of this with like a tape peel. Famous work done by Heikki Simola, where he looked at 418 years of Lovojärvi in southern Finland. And that is a lot of intervals to examine.
At a seasonal changes. Yeah.
So like, I don't know.
That was hundreds of samples.
And
I mean, you're not talking about a huge volume for each sample, but boy, that's a lot of work.
That is an insane amount of work. And, you know, when you think of just like one lake and now, so that was published in 1990. And now, like, I have never worked or known anyone that has worked directly on a tape peel analyses.
No, me neither.
You know, like we're now in like the advancements in imaging and stuff is, I guess, a lot of these, I guess, but that was diatom. So, but the fine resolution stuff is going to be more driven by XRF type analyses these days.
Yeah. I think there are people who still, you know, it's maybe a little more niche. But there are people who still work at very fine resolution, on freeze cores primarily because you can do that. You can set that interval and it doesn't really work that fine, for gravity cores, for example.
But
I think that the idea just in general, you have to be asking pretty specific questions to want to go to that sort of resolution. But it is part of the history of filling in how you can take advantage of these varved records before it's possible to start to date them. And then once you end up with that dating from a radioisotopic or some sort of chronological method, then that opens up the opportunity, not just in terms of where you can work, obviously, because varved versus no varved is an instant decision as to whether that would be applicable, but also the questions you can ask.
And then when varves aren't present, up until the 70s, there was no way to get any kind of real chronology. And I mentioned already, we talked in some detail in episode 3 about the mechanics of using radioisotopes to develop dates, but here in terms of just like, you know, the history timeline that we're forming here, the first use of lead-210 to date lake sediments is in a paper from 1971. And then there was like a burst of interest in a couple of different models in terms of whether you're using the constant initial concentration model or the constant rate of supply model. And so the CRS model is the one I'd say is most widely used today, but that, you know, was defined, established, developed,
published
in 1978. And then all of a sudden, so then you have that burst of activity in the 70s, and all of a sudden everything has changed in terms of there are now an ability to apply dates to the sediments from virtually any lake. Yes, there's caveats in some where it's problematic for whatever reason, but
not a method issue. It's a lake issue, yeah.
It's no longer limited to varb lakes. And then all of a sudden, the potential applications of what could be done with paleo just like exploded overnight once you're able to say how old a particular sediment interval was.
Mm-hmm.
And that
I don't know the answer. I was going to say, I don't know the answer to this question. I wonder if the CIC model, constant initial concentration, and the CRS model are the most widely known. They're the ones that are kind of are in the textbook chapters and that sort of thing. And there are some others like the CFCS model and things like that. I'm curious if there were others that are out there. Like there are models that were applied to the same kind of thing, but just never took off or were not as appropriate everywhere. Or there's just, it was a fairly niche kind of combination of radioisotope chemistry and mathematics that only a few people like Peter Appleby and Frank Oldfield and Edgington and those kind of names were interested in looking at. And I don't have a question. So like, for example, the first paper, the paper in 1971, the Krishnaswamy and Lal, I had never heard of that paper, even though I've applied the ideas of it, or at least the follow-on applications of it, many, many times. And it just makes me curious as to whether in that same time period, you know, there are all these ones that didn't make the cut and didn't get applied broadly.
Yeah, maybe. This is where, you know, my depth of knowledge is pretty shallow. And I've basically done the reading that I have needed to understand what's going on in dating. But I've never really dug into, you know, geochronology and, you know, what other potential avenues were explored. Like, you know, was Lead 210 the first one that was really looked at? I have no idea. Like, how many of the radio, like, isotopes that were either dead ends or not, maybe not dead ends, but less practical in terms of their usefulness, or didn't work quite so well, and then like Lead 210 was the winner versus the only one? I have no idea.
That's a good point, because it has, you know, it has that nice in between half life of 22 odd years that makes it really good for dating those time periods and how they arrived at that, because someone had to decide that Lead 210 would be something they would at least attempt to measure. And how they arrived at that is an interesting thing to think about, and whether there were maybe options that didn't make the grade.
Yeah. Other candidates that, you know, their, you know, the absorbance peak was, you know, less distinct or overlapping with other thing, background noise. Like, I'm sure there was a hunt that, you know, and things being crossed off a list by somebody.
Yeah, because it's pretty common. Like, it's a common isotope, right? It's part of a series that's everywhere. It's in the rocks. That's the beauty of it. Whereas some of the, well, just to compare to like the non-native radioisotopes like cesium and americium, those work great, but, you know, they have to be put into the environment, so they don't necessarily occur everywhere so well, and there are things about them. But lead-210 just seems to be a perfect choice.
Yeah. So that's something maybe we can explore another day. Like, was it an obvious choice, or was it like the result? Is it obvious only in hindsight?
Yeah, exactly. But all of that is an aside. What Adam said before I derailed us for a couple of minutes there with my thoughts was that absolutely without this, and with this now, the ability to answer all sorts of questions was there. And then kind of coincident with that was the emergence of a lot of these kind of problems that paleo was uniquely suited to attempting to disentangle.
One in particular had really exploded into the public consciousness around that time, and is really tied to the history of paleomnology very, very tightly, and that was acid deposition and acid rain. And so as we enter the 1980s, all the previous field, laboratory, and dating techniques had developed to the point that paleo was poised to address the question of the day, which was, had lakes acidified? And so before we get to the actual question, just a little bit of history on acid rain in general, I think it was the term itself was coined in something like 1872 by Robert Smith, based on work between the acidity of rain and atmospheric pollution in during the Industrial Revolution in like Manchester, England. So the idea of
your rain hometown there,
you know it, becoming acidic due to human influences have been established for a while, but public awareness of acid rain, especially in the US and North America in general, and I guess the Western world in general, really increased in the 1970s after reports from the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest in New Hampshire of the harmful environmental effects that are driven by acid deposition. And this is coming, again, as we've mentioned several times, on the heels of Silent Spring and the environmental movement kind of becoming a very wide... Present.
Yeah, it was well in the news, and all of the issues with over-fertilization had happened a little less than a decade before that. And it was just a time of sort of an environmental awakening. And at the same time, the sort of effects of this long-term history of acidic deposition, and then also the long-range transport of those pollutants from point sources, often to locations well outside of the industrial heartlands of the westernized world, we're all coming together.
Yeah. And it had become a super political issue, much like climate change is today, with their serious disputes or lines in the sand drawn between industrial advocates and environmentalists, disputes over whether some of these acidic lakes had always been acidic. And so there are a whole slew of basic questions that required a historical perspective that were not really answered yet, including had these lakes acidified? If so, when? By how much? What is the cause? Were lakes losing their fish populations due to acidification? And you know, at this time in the late 70s, early 1980s, these were serious questions that did not have any obvious answers. The first one would be, and we mentioned this before on the show, is, you know, if you're trying to reconstruct pH, you know, your direct measurements are only going to go back to the 1920s at the earliest, because that is when the pH function, the pH function was invented in 1909 and reached its modern form in 1924. But that means there's no modern measurements to compare against any earlier than the 1920s, yeah, anywhere in the world.
Why are we having this debate about climate change then? Because we've been measuring, like, Fahrenheit came up with his temperature scale in like 1720 or something like that. There's none of this question about pre-impact for temperature. So we can, you can't use that excuse, climate deniers.
Come on, man. Yes.
Which is a huge portion of our audience.
You got to keep the cone of silence. You can't reveal the handshakes the code words of our vast global scientific conspiracy hoax to the internet at large.
Oh, anyway. But yeah, no, that's a good point. It's, unlike temperature, you couldn't measure pH prior to the 1920s. So that was a legitimate question because it just didn't exist. There were no data on that topic. And so there was a need to quantify it. And so not only to be able to go back in time in the history of an ecosystem, but to be able to add a number to that, because for if you're going to introduce legislation that's going to curtail the emissions of large industrial operations, there needs to be some sort of numerical component added to that for it to get through the political system.
The arguments have to be convincing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, do this and this will happen. And, So we need an indirect means of measuring pH, and now we're going to kind of jump back in our timeline a little bit. But at this point, diatoms had already been flagged as a particularly useful biological proxy prior to dating. And so the first steps to quantifying diatom ecology with respect to pH occurred much earlier, not that much later than the development of pH. So it's work from the late 1930s, I guess it would have to be at the same time because pH would, as a measure, it explode onto the scene and then comparing lakes. But the work of Friedrich Husted in the late 1930s, dividing diatoms into categories that you'd still see referred to in the literature today. So this would be acidobiontic, acidophilic, indifferent, alkaliphilous, and alkalibiontic. And what are those categories, Josh?
So acidobiontic means only found in acidic conditions. Acidophilic being liking, or philic being the suffix, I guess, for enjoying or surviving in those conditions. Indifferent being having a broad range generally or being circumneutral. So I think neutral is the synonym for indifferent in this category. And then the opposite side of that. So being found in alkaline conditions, and then alkalibiontic is the one that's often dropped off of this list. Like if you see the Husted diatom pH categories, you often won't see alkalibiontic. And that's just so that means only found in alkaline or high pH conditions. And that's just not a common thing for diatoms because they tend to dissolve in high pH because they're siliceous cell walls. But there are some species, very rare species, that do not only prefer, but only survive in those conditions.
Acquire it. So yeah, so by the 1930s, you know, it had already been established that diatoms, you know, different species are found in different places with respect to the pH scale. And then this got developed further. So by the 1950s, the work of Gunnar Nygaard, dividing diatoms into indexes. And this is something, again, that you know, if you don't have to go too far back in literature to find references to index alpha, index omega, and index
epsilon.
Epsilon. And those are basically...
they're an estimate of the proportion of those species in those categories. They based on the Who-Said categories. So the acid units, I believe, are five times the abundance of the acidobiotic to like skew it towards the really acid species, plus the proportion of the acidophilic species divided by the same of the alkaline species. And then the omega and epsilon indexes are the same except divided by sort of the richness value. So as a standardization technique, as a way of kind of giving you, so a high index alpha would be a high proportion of acidic taxa versus alkaline taxa.
Yeah, and so in the 50s, I guess you're looking at successional communities of diatoms, applying these indexes to infer some things about what's going on in the lake. And then what we're going to start seeing more and more is the various threads that we've talked about over the last couple episodes kind of coming together. So then by the 1960s, you're starting to see the application of statistical techniques. So kind of growing out of a lot of the work we talked about when we're talking about the Hutchinson group, approaching ecology in a more mathematical way. So you're starting to see linear regression analyses being applied between the index values and measured pH. And so we're getting closer and closer to the ability to infer past pH through time. So that was being done at least in the 1960s. And so then all of a sudden, once you get to the 1970s, you're able to date the sediments on top of all of this work, and you're going just from like broad successional changes to being able to actually pinpoint to within a couple of years, plus or minus a couple of years, as you're going back, or at least in the more recent sediments, to identify timing of changes.
Yeah, and I guess there was some attempts to do this earlier than that. Some of these ratios and to apply them to other environmental changes or degradations or whatever it is, problems. And some of those may not have been kind of people thinking in that perspective, looking at the sediments, looking at changes in species as a way of reconstructing environmental conditions, but maybe, not as statistically rigorously. They didn't broaden sort of the mathematicians and the statisticians at this point to address the problem. So things like John Stockner used ratios of different diatoms based on their morphology. So it's often called the A to C ratio, the aphid to the centric ratio in the 70s. Often, I usually call it the pointy round ratio, but it's not exactly the same thing. Good ideas, but perhaps a little bit simplistic for the kind of questions. When you have such broad communities, so many different taxa with so many different environmental preferences, any of those more simplistic kind of ratios are always going to fall a little bit short because you're not really taking account of different species and individual species and their optimum and tolerances, which we know can be they can have the same optima, but very different tolerances, which make them respond quite differently to changes in that environmental variable. And that's why we really need to be able to quantify the taxa based on all of the information we have on their distribution across a wide range of lakes, as we know from how a training set works, in order to really be able to take advantage of those data.
And I think another thing, like in addition to what you're saying there about maybe the... I don't think it's a case necessarily that they weren't statistically rigorous enough, but the change, I think it might more have to do with pH and the changes being so much bigger. So if you're looking in a, you know, like a serious acidification story, it's becoming like 1,000, you know, even like 10,000 times more acidic. There are not too many eutrophication stories where your nutrient levels are going up by 10,000 times, let's say. So the scale of changes in some of these cases was so broad that the, you know, it's like it's coming in from both ends. It's like the changes are really big, and then, you know, a lot more wiggle room in the statistical end of things because less power is necessarily needed to identify said changes. So half a one and half a dozen one and six scalar kind of thing. But anyway, then we have this really coming together, the multivariate data sets that were available through diatom analyses brought statisticians in, because I'm not too sure if there were any equivalent data sets available anywhere for them to do these kind of analyses in terms of, like, yes, there's like multivariate analyses done on other things, but when you're working on much bigger scales of like meadowlands or grasslands or mammals or whatever, like the amount of effort you require to get like an assemblage of 400 different species in one particular environment, the scale was so much bigger as opposed to a single diatom.
And you would never, and also the variation too, is, yeah, I think that's the other point, is that, you know, in a location, you can go from really, really basic to really, really acidic lakes. In order to have that many samples in a grassland, they're all going to, you know, their community will be different, but they're all going to be in the same environmental context, whereas that's not the case with lakes. They can be so different from one another versus plots, which would be the ecological equivalent in most respects. And because of that, the potential is just so much broader for these techniques to really be developed based on that variation.
Yeah. And so it was really kind of, a bunch of things coming together at the same time. It's like you had the tool and like the people developing the tools are attracted to the question for one particular reason of pushing what could be developed on a statistical level. You had the ecologists interested on like the massive changes that were happening in terms of like the more policy-driven interest was coming because it was a very pertinent environmental question. All this is coming together, and then you're having, by the early 1980s, you're seeing transfer functions being developed between diatoms and diatom assemblages and lake water characteristics in large geographic areas, such as the Adirondacks.
Cool. And as we said, the computing power just came to be at the same time, as we talked about in episode 8. Doing these by hand is a pain, and having the computing power is a big part of it. So we end up with names that I think will be more familiar to listeners who are more early on in their journey through the paleolimnological approach. People like John Burks and Kyo Terbrock and Steve Juggins, all of whom were applying the, who are paleolimnologists, they're statisticians as well, and cross the boundary between these, and the ability to bring this statistical, mathematical mindset to the data of that are collected by paleolimnologists and the students at that time period.
Yeah, and so another whole development here was, and it was computational power. Personal computers are becoming available. To the point that, a professor on like an insert grant would apply to have a, 286 for I don't know how many $1,000s that would be able to crank through a PCA over the course of a weekend. That was like kind of, within the reach of the ecologist, like the computer science capabilities had escaped the mainframe in many ways.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah, the coding, even the coding language, like who would want to come up with a PCA on like punch cards? How the heck would that work out?
I'm sure the guy who developed PC, well, when did we do this? When was it was from the 20s,
the 30s, right?
Yeah,
20s or 30s.
So he would go, man, I wish we had punch cards.
Yeah, okay, fair enough, but not, yeah, fine, but not for someone who wants to run it on a regular basis applied to all of these different lakes or all these different data sets, so. No, it all comes together. And that means that by the early 1980s, we have all of the components we've just talked about, the environmental need, the questions, the political will, the techniques, all are together to take the cores, date the cores, analyze the data that come from them. in order to solve these problems. So, you know, one of those great success stories of the science. I'm not necessarily saying that it's been solved environmentally or politically, at least. But from a science
answer those questions.
Yeah, got and, done.
You know, there were major investigations that were like collaborative between many environmental groups, but the big ones that you know are well established in literature would be PIRLA 1 and 2. So these were paleoecological investigations of recent lake acidification. PIRLA 1 was very much focused on the Adirondacks, New England, the Great Lakes states, Northern Florida, and did a series of, I'm not sure how many, full cores. And that was like the, I guess, North American push to answer some of the questions around when and by how much lakes had acidified. At the same general time, you had work like the SWAP program in Europe. So that's a surface water acidification project. That's what it is. And then it had a paleolimnology program within it that is summarized by Batterby and Remberg in 1990. And it was looking at similar questions, but looking at sites in Norway, Scotland, and Sweden. And then that was done in the early 90s. The actual work was established in the 1980s. I'm not sure when the cores were collected, but the final kind of summary was published in 1990, saying that, yes, many of these lakes in these, you know, soft water regions did acidify. They're not as naturally acidic. They acidified, you know, in the 1950s and 60s-ish, depending on where you were.
Yeah, exactly when it would make sense based on the history of deposition of those pollutants.
And based on the diatomic sandwiches, they acidified it by this much. And then by the time PIRLA 2 rolled around, which is a little bit later, it was like the first, I don't think, I question a little bit whether it was the real first use of the top-bottom approach, but I think it's the first big use of the top-bottom approach. I'm not sure of any earlier ones, but I'm not sure if...
Well, I have to ask John about it.
I have asked John about it, and I don't think it is. But it's one of those things where there might be some earlier ones that would have been in a PhD thesis, but not necessarily published, of just like a small number of lakes, you know, but the boy where PIRLA was a little bit different. I think it's something like it's pushing like 40 lakes. You're getting a big regional coverage that is
specific to the Adirondacks.
To the Adirondacks. And the bottoms were defined by the dating profiles produced by the Adirondack lakes examined in PIRLA 1. So I think, so that's where it's a bit murky, that it may not be the first top bottom one, but it's probably definitely the first really big, really rigorous top one where you had lots of dates to establish what your bottom was, as opposed to, I don't know, some sort of
just like, the bottom of the core. Yeah, whatever it was at the very bottom of the core. Whereas knowing the date based on the sedimentation rate for lakes of that type or that exact lake, depending on if it was one that was in the original part of the study, does make it more rigorous. And then also the funding that would have come from being able to carry this out in order to address these kind of questions would have allowed it to be applied to a lot more lakes in a specific region. So I think it's really tightly constrained within a geographic region, unlike the PIRLA 1 project, in order to particularly focus in on the Adirondack Park area of New York. And that's where John Small enters into this story. And we only mention it not because, obviously because he was our supervisor, but we'll have him on the podcast in a few episodes in order to maybe flush out some of these parts.
Pick his brain a little bit about some of how this came to be. Because it's kind of funny. It's like, in some ways, like when you read this and you read it in a textbook, and I realize that John was a young man when a lot of this was going on. But once it enters the textbook and you have like the quest to solve acid rain and acid rain solved, it seems like ancient history in many ways. Mm-hmm. I was a little, you know, it's not that ancient history. I was alive for a huge chunk of this.
Yeah, work. Even I was. part of it.
And maybe I am an old man. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe,
well, maybe there is part of that. Perspective is
changing a little bit. But, you know, it's kind of funny. Over the course of this, it's like the transition in like a history episode from talking about Lewin Hook and his little animalcules. So that's ancient history. And then we're now into, oh yeah, no, I was, you know, I definitely remember news spots on acid rain when I was in elementary school that would have been contemporary to this stuff.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the other thing then I would say is that of all of these acidification projects that we've been talking about, another impressive thing is how quickly change did come about. So the Clean Air Act is not only about acidification, but there was a large revision or whatever kind of component of it that was specific to solving some of the issues or trying to address the issues of acid rain. And that was done in 1990. Not really more than a decade or a decade and a half after people started addressing these with some of these kind of applications. A little bit longer from the more experimental stuff like at Hubbard Brook, but not too much really in the grand scheme of things. So it does show that change can happen fairly quickly when the science is there and when there's the political will following that. So an interesting thing. So by 1990, the amendments—that's the word I was looking for before—to the Clean Air Act related to particularly sulfur dioxide emissions were enacted into law in the United States, and Canada followed, or was a little bit before. I can't remember the exact timing, but it's right around the same time period, and similar things in Europe.
The pace of development was so rapid. Like when you compare, so the first paper on dating of lead to 10, 1971, you know, the Clean Air Act goes into effect in 1990, I think.
Yep.
So you got 19 years from we have no idea how to date a sediment to, we've got, dating established, biological proxies established. We know over large regions of the globe what the acidification histories were. Fix this international problem. And, by the same token, what is it? The Kyoto Accord? When was that?
2005. 90, oh.
90, no, no. It's 92?
Oh, I don't. Is that long ago?
Kyoto Protocol? Yeah, so it's 28 years. Come on. Jesus. We've had 1.5 times. It should be fixed by now, this whole climate change malarkey.
But I think that's not a bad place to end this one. And
yeah, just to summarize, at this point, by the end of the 1980s, what I was trying to inarticulately say a minute ago is paleolimnology had absolutely coalesced over the course of that last 20 years into a well-recognized discipline. To the point that it had its own journal, JOPL, was founded in 1988. Three episodes in, paleolimnology has begun.
Yeah, although it happened apparently in 1927 based on that one thesis. But no, the modern paleolimnology, no doubt. The way anyone starting a degree today would recognize all of the steps and everything that goes into it. And
potentially even using some of the same tools.
Literally, same microscopes in some cases, same gamma counters or same corers, the stuff lasts. And is still as applicable as it was the day that it was purchased or built. But beyond acidification, as we move into the next episode and think about that, things become that little diversion about or digression about Kyoto was not a bad segue in some ways, because problems do become a little more complicated in some ways. We moved into a multi-proxy, multi-problem kind of world, and paleolimnology, I think, is capable of addressing some of those questions, and that's maybe what we'll get into in what I think will be the last episode, in episode 4.
We'll see if we can wrap it all up. Everything after acidification into 45 minutes or less. Maybe, maybe not, but that is the goal. And, I think, it's a good place to end it. Paleo has established itself, and then next time we'll be looking at paleo's life beyond pH.
Sounds good. Anything sort of general grab bag or
mailbag? Mailbag.
We had that one.
Nothing new in the mailbag this weekend.
That's okay. It took us 18 episodes to get the first email. So
as long as we're good by episode 36.
Yeah, exactly. But we did. By the time this comes out, we'll have passed 1,000 overall listens, which is not that many, but very exciting. So thanks to all of you who have taken the time to listen to an episode. We do appreciate it.
Especially the bots. Rack those numbers up, please.
Yeah, for sure. Popular, well, we've been talking about this week. I don't know why popular paleolimnology, an episode from like right in the middle almost of the catalog, has really taken off. So
we're basically inept and not knowing what we're doing. So we did something particularly magic with search engine optimization for that
pretty much episode. Yeah. So cool.
But yeah, if you want to get in touch with us about anything you've heard on the show today or any of the past episodes, are there any glaring mistakes, errors, or anything we've overlooked in this history so far, please let us know. You can contact us directly on Twitter. The Twitter handle is
Core Ideas Paleo.
Or you can send us an email at coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. If you want to look at the show notes that accompany all episodes and all past episodes, you can visit our website. Eventually, we'll have these history ones up, and I think they'll be a pretty cool resource going forward once they're done, but they take me a long time to do, so I'm behind. But you can visit coreideas.ajeziorski.ca. Honestly, just pull the web address off our Twitter page. Again, Core Ideas Paleo. Is that right?
That's right.
Core Ideas Paleo on Twitter. And that's the easiest way to get in touch with us. Find the website, because otherwise you have to spell my name. And until next time, thank you for listening. And we'll catch up with you for potentially the wrap-up of our history of paleolimnology.
Sounds good. Take care out there. Thanks again. And see you soon.